Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. In today's episode, I'm welcoming back one of my all-time favorite guests, writer Stephen Pressfield. Stephen's the author of several popular novels, including The Legend of Bagger Vance, Gates of Fire, and The Virtues of War. He's also written several popular nonfiction books on the creative process, like Do the Work and The War of Art, which covers how to overcome what he calls the resistance in any creative endeavor. Steve's got a new novel out called The Knowledge. It's based on his early days as a writer in 1970s New York City and provides the backstory of how he learned to overcome the resistance in his own life. Today on the show, Steve and I discuss how the resistance rears its ugly head in our lives and how to overcome it by transforming from an amateur to professional. We then talk about Steve's early days as a writer and the struggles he went through in becoming a pro. If you're somebody who hopes to be a writer or an artist or an entrepreneur, you're going to love this episode. It's filled with insights on the mindset you need to adopt in order to thrive in any creative endeavor. After the show is over, check out our show notes at aom.is/theknowledge. All right, Stephen Pressfield, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here, Brad. Thanks for having me.
So we've had you on the podcast before to discuss your works of fiction that deal with Greek history, Gates of Fire, the Virtues of War, some of my favorite books. But you have a new novel out called The Knowledge, a too close to true novel. And we're going to get into the details of the novel here in a bit because the story is fantastic. It's a bit of autobiographical fiction. There's some crazy stuff that happens in the book. So I want to know if this actually, some of the stuff actually happened to you. But before we get to that, I want to talk about what's on the inside of the jacket of the book, because I think it'll give some context about the details of the novel. You say this novel shares the origin tale of the ideas you laid out in your popular book, The War of Art. It's a book popular with entrepreneurs, artists, writers, etc. And the big idea there is this idea of the resistance. For our listeners who aren't familiar with that concept, can you briefly describe what the resistance is?
Well, if you're a writer, Brett, as you are, and as probably a lot of your listeners are, you know that when you sit down to the blank page, you can feel a force radiating off that empty page. And it's a negative force that's trying to make you go get a hot fudge sundae or go surfing or do something like that, anything other than actually face the page. And that is resistance with a capital R. It's this negative force that kicks in anytime we try to move from a lower level to a higher level or to enact any kind of creative instinct.
And this isn't just for writers. It can also happen in your life whenever you want to have a goal, like you want to lose weight. The resistance is go eat that hot fudge sundae.
Exactly. If you've ever brought home an ab machine or a treadmill or something and watched it gather dust, then you know what resistance is. It seems to kick in all seriousness, anytime we try to move from kind of a lower moral, ethical, spiritual level to a higher one, including in relationships, anything like that.
But so, yeah, I think everyone's experienced that resistance of, you know, writer's block or procrastination, or, you know, you buy the membership of the gym, and you just don't go. But are there some more insidious, forms of resistance where you don't think it's resistance, but it really is resistance?
Absolutely. I mean, I have a sort of a little motto that I ask myself and or that I apply in cases like that. And the motto is, when in doubt, it's resistance. You know, resistance kind of, it comes for me at least as a voice in your head. You know, that usually is trying to talk you out of doing the thing that you know that you have to do. And it may say something like, you're worthless. This is a terrible idea. Why did you even come up with this idea? It's been done a million times. You're never going to be able to finish it. That sort of thing. Or resistance will take the form of just distraction. Like I was just saying, it'll come up with any number of other alternatives that you might do. Log on to Facebook, log on to Snapchat, distract yourself with this or that. And in its darker forms, it gets into actual vices and, you know, drugs, alcohol, abuse of oneself or others, that kind of thing. And to get even darker about it, if you want me to, do you want me to keep going in this, Brett? one of the things is that people in our world, people that we're intimate with, sometimes they will embody resistance and lay it on us. For instance, if you decide that you're going to write the novel that you've always wanted to write, and you kind of get yourself together professionally and you start to do it, you're actually sitting down, you get it 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, what you'll find, dark as this is that the people closest to you, not all of them, but some of them, will start trying to sabotage you. And if you've ever seen movies by David O. Russell, like The Fighter with Mark Wahlberg or Joy, the recent one starring Jennifer Lawrence, he gets into these dysfunctional families where, you know, the mother, the sisters, the boyfriend, the wife, the husband will try to sabotage the person who is defeating his or her own resistance. So it's this resistance is a really dark force that is diabolical in the ways that it can get after you.
Right. And what's interesting too, and I think you talked about this in the war of art, is that, yeah, that example of people around you, people who love you, part of, you know, they're your family, your friends, they're going to bring you down when you're trying to improve yourself. They'll say, why are you changing? This is not the way it's supposed to be. And then you leave them, you know, kind of get away to do better. But then you find yourself being attracted or drawn to people who are just like your friends and family who are trying to pull you back down, like the proverbial crab in the bucket.
Yes, it's true, because that's now what's happening. What's the dynamic that's really happening when somebody else tries to bring you down in that kind of case is it's not that they're bad people. It's that they're dealing with their own unconscious resistance. For instance, they may have a dream that they, you know, feel in their heart that they want to do that they're not doing. So when they see you, Brett, when they see you writing your novel or doing, you know, creating your startup company or whatever it is, your actions become a reproach to them. Even, and this happens on an unconscious level. They don't even know they're doing it. And so they will say to you things like, what's happening to you, Brett? Man, you've changed. No, you used to be. We used to be able to get stoned together. We'd have a great time. Now you're going off and who do you think you are? You're better than us? That sort of is the ways that resistance manifests itself in the more insidious ways other than just a voice in your own head.
Right. So you argue that in order to overcome the resistance, you have to become a professional and stop being an amateur. What's the difference between a pro and an amateur in the way you frame it?
One of the things is when we fall prey to resistance, when we're mired in our own resistance and we just can't get anything done, sometimes we'll blame ourselves. We'll put a value judgment on it. We'll say, well, there's something wrong with me. You know, it's like I'm sick. I have some demented thing from childhood or whatever. Or, we'll blame ourselves, in other words. And the idea of amateur versus pro, turning pro in a situation like that. It's just, it worked for me, that thinking of it that way, in that it takes the value judgment out of it. You stop telling yourself that you're wrong, or you're quote unquote sick, or there's something, you know, that's not functioning right with you. Really, the mistake that we make when we get defeated by resistance is we're operating as amateurs. Now, what is an amateur as opposed to a pro? An amateur is somebody that, like, is a weekend warrior that doesn't really take it seriously enough, whatever their dream is. If you want to become a piano, professional piano player, right, or a concert pianist, what do you have to do? I mean, realistically, you have to commit yourself to hours and hours a day of working on your music and working on all the aspects of it, the career aspects of it, the health aspects of it, the mental toughness aspects of it, as well as the musical aspects of it. And the way that I found it worked for me is just to turn that switch in your mind where you say to yourself, I'm not going to be an amateur anymore. I'm not going to be a weekend warrior. I'm going to turn pro. I'm going to think of myself as a professional. And one of the things, but I know I'm rambling on here, but for instance, a pro, what does a pro do that an amateur doesn't do? A pro shows up every day. A pro stays on the job every day. A pro plays hurt. You know, I could go on and on, but that's, I think you get the idea of what I'm getting at there.
Right. One of the things I found in the War of Art that really helped me out is in that idea of trying to think of yourself as a pro, is thinking of your profession, whatever it is, if you're a writer, a business owner, like think of it as a corporate entity that's not you, right? Because I feel like a lot of writers, entrepreneur types, artists, they tie up their work with their self so much. So if they suffer defeat in that one aspect of their life, it just demolishes their entire self-worth. But when you separate that, you think, okay, this is my work. This is a corp. This is Steve Inc. over here. If I'm not doing good in Steve Inc., that means I'm not necessarily doing bad in my other areas of life.
Yeah, when I first got out to Hollywood and started working as a screenwriter, I learned, and this is in the War of Art, that many writers were incorporated, and they had their little one-man corporations. And when they signed a contract to do a script or screenplay, whatever it is, it would be FSO, for services of. So they would be, their corporation would sign the deal for the services of them as an individual, as a private person. And I thought that was a great way of separating the entity part of yourself that does the actual work from the entity that is sort of managing you. So you have to sort of, it's a great device to sort of split yourself in half. And the one half of you can kick the ass of the other half of you, you know, and also can encourage you and support you, you know. In our world, as writers or artists or entrepreneurs or whatever it is, we're competing with Facebook. We're competing with General Dynamics. We're competing with Frigidaire. We're competing with all these corporations out there. And we have to be as organized in our own minds, in our own selves, as they are. And we have to have, just as a place like Apple, let's say under Steve Jobs, has its corporate culture that demands a certain level of work and will not be satisfied below a certain level of excellence. We, you and I, as individuals, Brett, and anybody that's listening to this, we have to be Apple in our own heads and have that same sort of corporate culture, only on the individual level, that has a level of excellence that we aspire to and that we won't let ourselves fall below. And we have to be able to motivate ourselves, to reinforce ourselves, to pick ourselves up when we fall down. And all of those things are aspects of thinking of yourself as a professional instead of an amateur. For instance, an amateur, when an amateur encounters adversity, an amateur will quit. You know, they'll say, well, I'm just going to go to the movies. I'm going to hang out with my girlfriend. I'm going to whatever it is. But a professional, if you think about Michael Jordan or LeBron James or something like that, they wake up in the morning, they've got a high ankle sprain, they've got a broken finger on their shooting hand. They play. They show up. Because they have that professional attitude. Whereas the amateur might quit and just say, it's too rough today. I can't handle it. The professional will get in the arena and do his or her job.
Right. And I think one thing you talk about too is the amateur is really tied up. I mean, amateur means that you do it for the love of the whatever, right? You do it for the love of the sport. But love, it's a feeling. Feelings are fleeting. And sometimes you feel like you love it and sometimes you feel like you don't love it. And so I guess that's one of the reasons why an amateur be more susceptible to the resistance.
Yeah, I would even put it in a slightly different way, Brad. It's like the word amateur comes from the Latin root, amo, amas, amat, meaning that somebody that plays for the love of the game only, right? As opposed to playing for money, let's say. But to me, the amateur doesn't love the game enough, because if they loved it enough, they would commit to it full bore the way a professional does. And they would think of it. Even, if you're a writer, even if you don't have an agent, you haven't been published, you're sitting there working on a novel or whatever it is, and realistically you figure the best I can do is self-publish this on Amazon and, it'll sell 200 copies. Nonetheless, you have to think of yourself as if you are Philip Roth or Toni Morrison. You have to operate as a full-bore professional or you'll never get to that level.
So, how do you make the switch? Is it just like a mental switch you flip in your brain? Like, okay, I'm no longer an amateur, I'm a pro. Or does it involve embodied actions, right, to help you, train?
Well, it's both, Brett. That's a great question. But it really is a simple mental switch. Like, to me, it's an analogy with when somebody recognizes that they're an alcoholic, right? They wake up face down in a gutter at 4 in the morning for the 20th time, and suddenly it dawns on them, oh my God, I've got to come out of denial. I really do have a problem with alcohol. And at that point, if the person is going to survive, they make that mental switch in their head and they basically turn pro and they say to themselves, I have a problem. I can't handle it by myself. I've got to get help. And then they join AA or they take some sort of step and they change their life. In other words, it's both of what you said, Brett. It's that decision that is like flipping a switch. But after that decision happens, then there has to be a total change in the way a person lives their life. And I always say that an amateur has amateur habits and a pro has pro habits. And they're completely different one from the other. And it's a great exercise for an individual to sort of ask themselves, how do I pursue whatever this is, whatever my dream is, to be a photographer, a filmmaker, an actor, or whatever it is? Am I pursuing it with amateur habits or am I pursuing it with professional habits? And if you're doing it with amateur habits, you got to flip the switch and pursue it with professional habits.
Okay, let's circle back to the knowledge now, because these ideas you wrote about in The War of Art, like this, the knowledge is about where you got these ideas from. It's a fiction novel about a struggling writer living in gritty 1970s New York City who makes money on the side driving cabs and managing a band. And then the writer gets involved with his boss's underworld dealings when he has to start tagging his boss's wives around New York City. Lots of hijinks ensue. Really great book. But the book says it's the too close to true novel. So this stuff happened to you. There's a lot of crazy stuff that happens in this novel. Exactly how close does it follow this period of your life as an artist?
Pretty close. If you eliminate the murders and stuff like that, that's obviously tarting reality up a little bit. But the basic internal story, just like we were talking about a couple of minutes ago, Brett, about the, it's really, when you talk about the struggling writer, this really was me at that era in New York. I'm driving a cab, I'm tending bar, I'm writing a book, I'm doing all kinds of other stuff, writing my third book, actually all three of them failed, you know, never got published. Basically what that story is a, it's a person that's living the amateur life and allowing distractions and, you know, in the form of sex, drugs, blah, 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 all of the other crazy stuff that we all get into in that sort of time in our life. And the turning point at the end of the book, it could be looked at as the protagonist turning pro. And so it's as simple as that. The villain of this book, The Knowledge, is simply resistance with a capital R, just what we're talking about here. It's not any individual. There's no bad guy that's going against the protagonist. It's all inside his head as he sabotages himself in his struggles to be a writer. And finally, what happens, I was talking about, you know, waking up face down in a ditch and saying to yourself, you know, gee, I do have a problem with alcohol. That is the sort of the all is lost moment for the hero of this book, The Knowledge, is he sort of finally totally crashes and burns and says, wakes up and says to himself, I do have a problem. I'm sabotaging myself. There's some demon inside me that's stopping me from, you know, just getting out of my own way. And at that point, he makes the decision that he's got to change something, you know, because he realizes, you know, the alternative is basically to die. So, the events of the novel, The Knowledge, many of them are true to my true life, and they are the events out of which the ideas of the War of Art came, and for me, and when I sort of realized that there was this negative force called resistance, that it was beating the crap out of me day after day, year after year, and that I had to get a handle on it one way or another, or I was just going absolutely nowhere, and my life was going down the toilet.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million bucks, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. And now back to the show.
Right. And in the novel, the protagonist, who's also named Stephen, he encounters people, individuals, friends, coworkers, who it seems like they planted the seeds of this idea that he needs to turn pro or else he's not going to survive. He's not going to thrive. I'm curious, when you were in New York City at this time in your life, did you encounter people like that, that planted the seeds of these ideas of the resistance and turning pro?
Yes, definitely. And I think we all have those people in our lives, right? There may be a boss or a mentor that is like constantly trying to kick us in the butt and get us to see what we can't see and what we're in denial of. Or maybe we have a friend or a spouse or girlfriend or boyfriend, and where you have those, maybe it's in a moment of a terrible fight when they just sort of unload on you and they say, you know, look in the mirror and, you know, see what you, that sort of stuff, right? So yeah, there definitely were characters and people in my life that were really positive influences on me, and some of them are in the book, literally. And I think we all have that in our lives. We do have friends and people who love us who are trying to make us see what's right in front of our face when we're in denial of it, as I certainly was and a lot of people are.
Right. And sometimes your friends just act as an example. I guess in the novel, Stephen has a friend who works in an ad company who's just super disciplined, meditates, gets up early, just does everything by the book, right? He has a routine and he sticks to it. He's a pro. And it seems like now in your life that, you know, routine, ritual is really important to you as well. So I imagine there was someone in your life that you encountered that was just like that.
Yeah, that's exactly true. And it really is. There are so few people I find who actually do possess self-discipline. If you think about, you know, you look through your own life and everything like you do, Brett, that's for sure. And coming up, I had maybe just one friend really that did that, you know, that would get up with the crack of dawn and, you know, do piano stuff and meditate and do that sort of thing. And he was a role model to me, and I basically tried to become him and have copied so much of the way I live right now from this one particular friend. So, role models are tremendously important. And in a way, I mean, what you're doing with The Art of Manliness is trying to be a sort of online role model for a lot of people. And I'm trying to do that myself on my blog, because it helps. Nowadays, you know, people that get it online rather than in person.
Let's talk about the title of the book, The Knowledge. It comes from in the novel, Stephen and his friend Gil work on this concept music album, and they call it The Knowledge. And it's based off of The Knowledge, which is what London cabbies have to memorize to become cab drivers. Basically, London cabbies have to like memorize the entire map of London and all the cattywampus, you know, streets there and how to get to different places. I mean, it takes 2 or 3 years for someone to memorize this stuff. But, you know, for Stephen and Gil in the novel, the knowledge seemed to represent something higher. So what did the knowledge represent for Stephen and Gil?
That's a great question, Brett. And you're right. The knowledge in terms of London taxi drivers is sometimes it's referred to as the hardest test in the world. And these guys who want to be London cab drivers, there's like 20,000 different lanes and streets in London. And they will literally get on a bicycle or a moped or something. And for 2 years, you know, with a pad and a pencil, they'll ride around London just trying to memorize where all the streets go. And they have to pass, you know, a test where somebody will say, you know, how do you get from Earl's Court to Shepherd's Bush, you know, and you got to play that back. So I asked myself as writing this book, what's the metaphor here? And the metaphor is just as a cabbie has to learn the geographic layout of the city of London, what you and I, as writers or artists or entrepreneurs, or just as human beings, we have to learn the knowledge, quote unquote, of life, of the city. The city of life, and we have to learn how to navigate from A to B and all that sort of stuff. But in the concept that I was applying it in the book, it was not only knowledge of the real material world, but knowledge of our interior world. And when we're talking like we were before, Brett, about resistance and about self-sabotage, that sort of stuff, we have to learn the knowledge of our inner city, our inner London that's inside us, how to navigate around our own self-imposed roadblocks. And beyond that, I would even go to say that it was knowledge of previous lives or other things from dimensions that are beyond the material dimension or even the interior dimension. So it's sort of like we come out of the womb. We're in this strange place called planet Earth, where we have an unconscious and we have a conscious, and we have the world out there in front of us. And from infancy, we're trying to master it. Like, where are we? Who are we? Why are we here? what are we trying to do and how can we do it? What is it all about? These are the questions that everybody asks themselves. And that, in terms of the book, that's what, quote unquote, the knowledge means.
But why do you think sometimes seeking the knowledge, right, it ends up swallowing people, you know, mentally, emotionally, and sometimes physically? You know, they do themselves harm trying to seek out the knowledge. And why do you think that happens to people?
Well, you know, it's a big world and it's a dangerous world and it's full of a lot of negative and evil stuff. And I'm talking about inside our own heads. We don't have to look for bad people out there who will harm us. So it really, when we sort of, you know, most people live life on a very shallow level, right? They don't, if they have a job, if they have a spouse, if they can raise a family, they're happy with that, right? But when any of us try to go deep, we're playing with fire because there are a lot of blind alleys out there and alleys that will take you down, down sinkholes. That's why I think mentors are so important, and finding somebody that just like, this is a bad analogy, Brett, but like, you know, when a young quarterback comes into the NFL, let's say, the coach will not throw him into a game too soon, right? Sometimes a quarterback, even Aaron Rodgers, was played behind Brett Favre for years, right? And there have been many players that are thrown into the deep end too soon. And it can ruin you. That's just the way life is, you know? So that's why mentors and coaches and role models are so important that can sort of lead the young person, you know, like Obi-Wan Kenobi and Luke Skywalker, can lead the person one step at a time and not expose them to too much too soon. Because it's a dangerous world out there and inside our own heads. And that was what the character, actually his name was Peter, in the book. That was why that character was in the book, to represent the dangers of pursuing art too deeply, or pursuing the knowledge too deeply when you're not prepared and don't have the mental discipline and the mental self-knowledge.
Yeah, and I think that ties in nicely with one of the other things that you talk about in The War of Art about being pro. We talked about this a bit already, but being detached. You have to keep a little detachment from your work and even from the task of seeking that higher thing you're looking for as well, or else it will end up doing a lot of damage.
I think that's true. It's a great point, but it's like, one of the attributes of a professional, I think, is that they don't take success or failure personally. They can sort of split themselves in half and say, okay, I had a great success, but I'm not going to let it get my head swelled. Or, okay, I crashed and burned, but that doesn't mean that I'm a loser. I did something wrong. I'll correct it. And I think it's great to have that sort of witness perspective as well as the man in the arena perspective as we're navigating life. And it's a mistake, I think, to take things too personally, to be so totally engaged in something that when an endeavor fails, it's like we have failed as human beings and as souls, which is not the case at all. It's just an endeavor that's failed. We'll dust ourselves off. We'll get up again. We'll try again.
Right. So in the novel, the protagonist, he's in his late 20s, thereabouts. And the book ends with him leaving for California in a van with his beloved cat. And you actually had a cat, right? At this time period in your life? Yeah. I love that, how you love the cat. So he has the knowledge about overcoming the resistance. So I'm curious, what happens to this protagonist when he gets to sunny LA? Does he experience wild, immediate success, or does it take time even after you acquire the knowledge of the resistance and turning pro?
That's another great question, Brett. And well, I'll tell you what really happened was that after I left New York in my late 20s, having given up on writing novels, I just figured I just can't do it. It's beyond me. I'll be like Peter. I'll wind up killing myself if I keep doing this. And so I said, I'm going to reinvent myself. I'm going to go to LA. I'm going to try to be a screenwriter. And so at that point, I had sort of flipped the switch to being a professional. But the bottom line was it took me like another 6 or 7 years before I made the first penny. So there was plenty of struggle and plenty of lessons learned and almost like getting a PhD in a field that you don't, you know, that doesn't have an actual college. It took, in the real world, it took a long time. And I would think even if you would imagine what would happen to that fictional character in the knowledge, that probably the same thing would happen to him. It's not, success is not just going to come immediately to him, but at least he's turned the corner and is operating as a professional now and not as an amateur, even though he isn't making any money yet.
Right. At what point in your life did you start trying to write a novel again?
Another great question. It wasn't for, let me see. The novel was The Legend of Bagger Vance, and it was like another 15 years after I left New York and went to LA.
Why do you think it took that long? You were just focused on do you think there was like some resistance going on there? Like you were using screenwriting, like that was the resistance to writing the novel, you think?
I was so traumatized I worked for like maybe 13 years trying to write novels, you know, supporting myself doing these crazy jobs, and they all failed. So I was just totally traumatized by that. And I pretty much had made up my mind I was never going to try it again. So, but working in the movies was a real college education, PhD, in learning about the principles of storytelling and learning about how to conduct yourself as a professional and how to manage your emotions. And I think at some point that seed that had been planted 15 years earlier, or that I had put away 15 years earlier, it just sort of stayed dormant through that time. And then it just kind of popped up. And it popped up when I had the idea for The Legend of Bagger Vance. It kind of just popped into my mind, fully formed, and as a book, not as a movie. So I sort of knew, okay, I've got to switch. I've got to go back into this arena that I had failed in so miserably. But oddly enough, it was a piece of cake. And the book came out of me fast and got bought fast and got made into a movie fast.
Right. That's the muses in action there, right?
Yeah, I guess so. It's the unconscious. It's the goddess, you know, inspiring us. It's things we can't explain. You know, we're trying to find the knowledge of that, but it's beyond us.
So, Stephen, do you still struggle with the resistance today, even though you have this pro mentality?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, it never goes away. It's just as, I always say it's you have to slay the dragon again every morning. Never goes away, never gets any easier. The only thing, I'm sure you know this yourself, Brett, from, you know, all the work that you do, is you've had enough success, you've faced it down enough times that you know you can do it now, which is different from when you were first starting out. You didn't know if you could defeat it at all. But now at least you know, I've done it 10,000 times, so I guess I can do it again today. But it's always there, and it's always ready to kill you, and it will kill you if you let it.
Well, Stephen, this has been a great conversation, and there's a lot more we could talk about, but where can people learn more about the knowledge and the rest of your work?
Everything is on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, but I also have a blog that's just my name, www.stephenpressfield.com. And everything is there. And I do a Every Wednesday, I do a post called Writing Wednesdays, and it's sort of like an ongoing chapter in the war of art, and it's about the craft, and it's about professionalism, and it's about, you know, overcoming the demons of self-sabotage within us. So let me thank you, Brett. Thanks for having me on the podcast here, and thanks for the great questions. It's always fun to get into this studio with you.
Well, thanks so much, Stephen Pressfield. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure. My guest today was Stephen Pressfield. His latest book is called The Knowledge. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can find more information about Stephen's work at stephenpressfield.com. Also, check out our show notes for this episode at aom.is/theknowledge, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. If you enjoy this show, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. That helps out a lot. As always, thank you for your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.